Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. A big influence in my life was biologist Frances Hammerstrom. She and her husband Frederick, or Hammy, lived in the Plainfield area in the Central Sands of Wisconsin and were famous for their pioneering research on prairie chickens. Fran was born in 1907 and has written many books that take us on adventures back into her time and her and Hammy's conservation research work. I was lucky to meet her and work a little bit with some of her gaboons, or interns, and I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to read some of her writings to you. I read earlier from Walk When the Moon is Full. I think she is most well known for that book, so today I'll be reading the first pages of Birding with a Purpose of Raptors, Gaboons, and Other Creatures. An old-fashioned background. Birdwatching, for me, tends to be with a purpose. As a child, I used to borrow my mother's pearl-handled opera glasses and climb high into the tops of the oaks and the hickories to see what the warblers were doing. My favorite oak held a small pool in a hollow crotch, high, high above the ground after each rain. I found myself a perch still higher so I could look down at my pool and watch the birds come to drink. They sometimes fought, and as I watched them day after day, a pattern developed. Some birds were king and could have the pool any time they wanted. Others fought for their turn at the pool, and still others only slipped to the pool when no other birds were around. I wondered why. Were certain individuals more domineering? A screech owl roosting in a rhododendron was discovered by a blue jay, and more jays came screeching and diving to mob it. As far as I knew, nobody had ever watched anything like this before. This was the day I started to write my first bird book. Chapter 1, How the Jays Hated the Screech Owl. Other chapters followed. Knowing nothing about plagiarism, if I found a good chapter for my book in a magazine, I cut it out and pasted it in. Sometimes I pasted my own handwritten account right over someone's published story, convinced that mine was right and his account was wrong. In retrospect, I now see I was beginning to make progress as a scientist, for I no longer believed everything that was printed, a valuable lesson that some grown-ups have not learned yet. My early problems with bird identification were stupendous. The only book I owned that could help me at all was the Look About You Nature book. It was beautifully illustrated with vivid colored pictures, but this charming volume was British, and no one pointed out to me that the birds of Great Britain are not the same species we have in the United States. I kept my birding increasingly secret. I hated being laughed at whenever I called crows rooks or referred to chickadees as tits. Besides, before long I managed to get a BB gun and started collecting birds. This came about after my governess took me to a museum on one of our daily walks. She let me take a dead bird found by the roadside with me for identification. The men in the museum were delighted. They praised me and they showed us the workroom where the stuffing of birds in lifelike positions was done. A small man was putting the final touches on an exquisite thrush standing on a twig and singing with its mouth open. I leaned so close to see better that one of my long braids fell over his shoulder. He grunted and pushed me aside. I apologized and my governess took me away. It would have surprised me to even suspect that the man and I were about to become fast friends. What I did know was that I needed dead birds for taxidermy and for a way to get back to this wonderful Ward's Natural History Museum in Hyde Park, just a mile from our house. It never occurred to me that they might let me in the door, even if I had the temerity to arrive without at least one dead bird. Thereafter, I visited the museum alone, escaping from adult supervision on my bicycle. Something told me that my family would not understand if they found out, one, that I had a gun, and two, that I had a friend who traded me glass eyes to put in the birds I mounted for my private collection in exchange for specimens of rarer birds that the museum wanted. I learned to identify the birds of Massachusetts by wandering around in that museum and studying labeled specimens, and I felt it my duty to supply them with as many specimens of the birds on their want list as I possibly could. My family graciously gave me a vacant room for my hobbies. It contained my insect collection, my mammal collection, my bird collection, my egg collection, arsenical soap for preserving skins, and things that I just happened to like. For example, a doll's bureau with a secret compartment for hiding small objects. Dolls were not part of my world. If my parents had wished to foster my passionate interest in natural history, and they did not, they would have discovered that we lived only 3 miles from the Brush Hill Bird Club and would have enrolled me as a junior member. It was my great good fortune not to learn of the Brush Hill Bird Club. Perhaps I'm unfair, but I have a sneaking suspicion that they would have dissuaded me from my private collections, my gun, and perhaps even from my personal wild animal hospital, to which our neighbors brought injured creatures for me to nurse back to health. Among those injured creatures was a kestrel. I nursed her back to health and recognized that she was a falcon, so I read all the books I could read on falconry. I trained her until she took English sparrows day after day as they went to roost in the ivy on the church. The period 1915 to 1925 was a time of transition in American ornithology. Bird clubs were forming, and for many people, birding was becoming a pastime. By some fluke of fate, I found the professionals, and the direction my life was to take was clearly spelled out by the time I was 15. Later, as an adult, I published technical papers on all the subjects that I have touched on. This book traces the evolution of many ornithological techniques. When I got engaged to Frederick Hammerstrom in 1929, he said, "Lay off that insect stuff. We're going to work on game animals." I gave my collections to museums and moved into the wildlife profession with him. Frederick is quiet and scholarly. I had no idea that my life with the birds would ever turn out to be so rowdy, or that I someday would borrow falconry techniques to study fighting chickadees. And chapter next, A Bird in the Hand. The more I watched birds, the more I realized that what I was seeing was meaningless because I could not distinguish between individuals. Two good chickadee fights outside the kitchen window of our farmhouse in the winter of 1935-1936 exasperated me to the point of taking action. Was one bully responsible for the fights? Were the chickadees behaving like children in school? I devised a trap by putting an upside-down box of wire over a chunk of suet, propping it up with a stick, to which I fastened a string that ran into the kitchen. Catching that bully was no problem. My problem was finding a way to mark it. My first bird band was out of solid gold. I dumped my jewelry box on the kitchen table, found a necklace that I could pry apart, and bird number one carried a gold band. I released it, and it went straight back to feast on the chunk of suet inside the trap. Another chickadee zoomed down to feed. Number one flew to a jack pine, and with a mighty jerk, I pulled the string again. Happily, I prepared to destroy more jewelry, and holding the chickadee in one hand, I pushed useless rings, bracelets, and necklaces to one side of the table, hoping to unearth a band. Only another link of gold necklace would fit a chickadee, but I had forgotten which leg I'd put my first band on, so I couldn't name them gold right and gold left. If I had known how easy it was going to be to catch chickadees, I would simply have let the bird go. Instead, I put it in a paper bag, closed the top with a piece of string, and punched a few air holes in the paper and with a darning needle. I put on a jacket and made a hasty trip to the dump back of our barn. Dumps always give me ideas. I wandered, not aimlessly, on the dump and stopped to reflect when I found some broken celluloid toys. It was cold and snow sputtered around me, but I managed to light a match and learned that celluloid could be bent when heated. When Frederick came home, he found me not cooking supper, but emptying my pockets of headless dolls, toy wagons, and a broken fire engine. "Aren't the colors wonderful?" "Colors?" "Yes, for chickadee bands. Can you find me a nail the size of a chickadee leg?" You let the fire die down. And it was getting dark. Guiltily, I quickly heated up a pot of mulligan while Frederick, who had had a long day in the field, got our wood stove roaring and found me a nail the size of a chickadee's leg. After eating and warming up, we spent an interesting evening together. We cut the toys apart into narrow strips. One by one, we dipped the strips into boiling water, wrapped them around the nail, held them in the boiling water bath using two pairs of pliers and two people. Then we placed each neatly coiled band on a dish towel. The chickadee from the paper bag bit persistently as we struggled to put his band on. Somewhat reluctantly, I released him into the night, but the next morning, Red Wright was one of the first birds at the feeder. Sometimes I thought I caught a glimpse of a gold band, but I couldn't be sure. There has to be a better way of marking chickadees, I grumbled. Frederick, who was shaving by the kitchen window near the feeder and trying to spot bands for me, heartily agreed. How about colored feathers? I found a useful feather in the speculum of a dead mallard. By cutting off most of one feather in a chickadee's tail and just the tip of the shaft of the mallard feather, I could slip one over the other and glue the shafts together with household cement. The mallard feather was too big, so I trimmed it down to size with Frederick's mustache cutting scissors. Mallard speculum could be spotted instantly at about 10 yards without binoculars, and none of the other chickadees seemed to pay the slightest attention to his strange plumage. Blue jay tail followed, but I had to use a new technique. I glued a morsel of a blue jay's feather directly onto a chickadee tail feather. Woodpeckers and guinea fowl provided further useful feathers, but it was plain that we were dealing with a large flock and needed more colors quickly. A trip to the university at Madison was a bonanza. Dear old Professor Wagner lent me funnel traps and a biological survey bird bands, but best of all, the curator of the museum actually pulled some brightly colored feathers out of his bird skins for me and then gave me a whole badly stuffed parrot, gorgeously gaudy with vivid primary colors. When winter came again, I was ready to start my study. Here's what I found out. 1. It takes more than 1 year of winter feeding to build up a chickadee flock. 2. Big flocks precipitate fighting. 3. A chickadee, once worsted by a given individual, could count on being vanquished by the same bird at the next encounter. We saw only one exception in 76 fights. 4. Chickadees bite and have an uncanny knack for seizing upon the tender skin at the base of a fingernail. At the time, Frederick and I were both students of Aldo Leopold, and we had planned to use part of the prairie chicken research for my master's thesis. But both Leopold and I saw that no part of the chicken work would split off handily. It needed to fit together, and it only made sense for the whole kit and caboodle to go into one thesis, Frederick's. Finally, I said, Aldo, I have some material on chickadees. Chickadees, Fran. He settled back in his chair. I had no idea that you were interested in chickadees. I've been watching color marked populations for 3 winters. Color marked. A couple of weeks later, I brought him my master's thesis almost in final form, Dominance in Winter Flocks of Chickadees, which was published in the Wilson Bulletin in 1942. Leopold asked, how did you come on this idea? I didn't think to tell him of a child who had perched in an ancient oak watching unmarked birds coming to drink at a high ephemeral pool. And that's Frances Hammerstrom, beginning of her book, Birding with a Purpose, of Raptors, Gaboons, and Other Creatures. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.